Good evening for WBAI News in New York. I'm Linda Perry with some of the news for Wednesday, April 12, 2017. Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov and former Exxon CEO as Secretary of State Rex Tillerson met in Moscow today. They held a lengthy news conference. Tillerson expressed confidence that the Assad regime in Syria is responsible for last week's chemical attack. Lavrov says his government isn't sure of that, and the two don't agree on what stability in Syria looks like. Meanwhile, at the United Nations, UN envoy Stefan de Mistura addressed the Security Council. He says fragile progress made during recent negotiations between the Syrian government and opposition forces are now in grave danger.
The stakes in Syria today are very high. We all know why. In light of the recent developments, two paths lie before us. One is more outrages, more destruction and death, stoked by regional and international divisions, or even escalation and deeper confrontation. That is what all Syrians fear, and I share their fears. But there is another path, more serious discussion, a real de-escalation and ceasefire, and a rallying behind the only way out of the Syrian nightmare.
And de Mistura says political statements have sent worrying signals from both the Assad regime and opposition forces.
The government stated its intention to reconquer the entire territory of Syria rather than emphasizing a ceasefire on and with real negotiations. Some opposition voices, on the other hand, also expressed support for military offensives, including battles led by internationally prohibited terrorist groups, or cast even doubts on the need to return to Geneva and give priority to military solutions. Then, as representatives from over 70 countries and international organizations gathered in Brussels in what was supposed to be and has been an important meeting regarding the future of Syria, and address Syrian humanitarian needs and commit to a post-transition reconstruction, which is terribly needed, we witnessed the horrors inflicted by chemical weapons on Syrian innocent victims, including children, women, and men in Khan Sheikhoun.
After the chemical attack and the U.S. missile strike, de Mistura says the country has seen an increase in violence on the ground.
We have seen more fighting and violence, with new claims of the use of cluster ammunition in inhabited areas, barrel bombs, incendiary weapons, including in close proximity to Khan Sheikhoun itself. Secretary General has made clear his own position. He is abhorred by the chemical weapons attack in Khan Sheikhoun and calls for accountability for such crimes. In the aftermath of the U.S. strike, he is mindful of the risk of escalation and appeals for restraint. He called for reinstating a national-wide ceasefire, and he called for a refocus on the need for a political solution, which is also essential in the fight against terrorism.
Bashar al-Jafari is the Syrian ambassador to the United Nations. He blamed the United States for spreading disinformation about the chemical attack last week, denying any involvement in it, blaming rebel groups instead. To drive his point home, he went back to the lead-up to the Iraq War and false evidence provided by the U.S. about WMDs in Iraq.
1 week ago, we thought that we would be coming to this meeting to inform you of the progress achieved recently in Astana and Geneva, and to give the necessary momentum and support to His Excellency the Special Envoy, de Mistura, and to all parties who work seriously to reach a political settlement to the crisis in my country, Syria, and to coordinate our counter-terrorism efforts. Despite this optimism, the U.S. administration decided to repeat the same bloody theatrical play that it had staged 14 years ago in this council against Iraq, a play entitled The Lie of the Iraqi WMDs. Once again, the U.S. administration is taking the terrorist war against my country, Syria, to unprecedented and dangerous levels by switching from a proxy aggression through armed terrorist groups under their control for years to a new and direct aggression through a direct military action in Syria. The United States has been leading terrorism in Syria along with its allies and agents in the region. It has provided all forms of support to terrorist groups to commit the most heinous crimes against civilians and against Syrian infrastructure. These include the practices of the so-called international coalition. Recent incidents have proven that this coalition has only destroyed infrastructure, bombarded civilians, and provided air cover to al-Nusra Front, ISIL, and other affiliated terrorist groups.
The Syrian UN ambassador says the Trump administration is using the same red line which the Obama administration almost used against the government in Syria.
The former U.S. president had only to create what he called a red line, saying that any use of chemical weapons in Syria would not be tolerated. That red line was used to justify a military aggression against Syria. However, fortunately, he backtracked at the last minute when his European allies decided to jump ship, given pressure from the international public opinion and the rejection of any interference in my country, Syria. Madam President, documents leaked by WikiLeaks prove that the White House had given a green light to a chemical attack in eastern Ghouta, in the suburbs of Damascus, to put the blame on the Syrian government and to use that attack as incentive for an international military aggression against my country, Syria. Today, Madam President, the new U.S. administration, and we had hopes when that new administration started its work in Washington, this same administration who claims that counterterrorism is one of its priorities, could not but go back to the same pretext, the red line pretext, and to fabricate the incident of the chemical weapons in Khan Sheikhoun, to launch an attack against Syria, and to sabotage the Astana and Geneva talks.
And agreeing with Sergey Lavrov, Bashar al-Jafari says his government is willing to have an investigation into who used the chemical weapons.
My country has sent to you and to other members of the Council a letter inviting you and inviting the Director General of the OPCW, inviting him to send a technical mission to Khan Sheikhoun and to Shuairat Air Base to uncover the truth. Which means that the Syrian government wants to know who used the chemical agent in my country, Syria. We should all raise our voices in unison and say no, no, no to war, no to the war that is being promoted by warmongers and the enemies of law. They say that this is business as usual. They say that while they sit comfortably in their homes, enjoying their privileges, their revenues, and their arrogance.
Bashar al-Jafari, the Syrian ambassador to the United Nations, speaking at the Security Council today in a meeting to discuss the ongoing crisis in Syria. Late this afternoon, Jens Stoltenberg, NATO Security General, joined Donald Trump at the White House for a news conference. It was to be on U.S.-NATO relations, but the focus was on Russia. Donald Trump says from everything he's hearing, discussions in Moscow went well.
It would be wonderful if NATO and our country could get along with Russia. Right now, we're not getting along with Russia at all. We may be at an all-time low in terms of relationship with Russia. This is built for a long period of time. But we're going to see what happens. Putin is the leader of Russia. Russia is a strong country. We're a very, very strong country. We're going to see how that all works out. Last night, separately, I spoke with a man that I've gotten to know. I don't know Putin, but I do know this gentleman. I've spent a lot of time with him over the last 2 days, and he is the president of China. You were there, most of you were there, and it was quite an interesting period of time. President Xi wants to do the right thing. We had a very good bonding. I think we had a very good chemistry together. I think he wants to help us with North Korea. We talk trade. We talk a lot of things. And I said, the way you're going to make a good trade deal is to help us with North Korea. Otherwise, we're just going to go it alone. That'll be all right, too. But going it alone means going it with lots of other nations. But I was very impressed with President Xi. And I think he means well, and I think he wants to help. We'll see whether or not he does.
Do you feel like you have a deal with him? And if I could just start, do you feel like you have a deal with him in terms of the currency manipulation designation? And have your views changed on Putin?
We're going to see. We're going to see about that. And I'll also see about Putin over a period of time. It'd be a fantastic thing if we got along with Putin and if we got along with Russia. And that could happen, and it may not happen. It may be just the opposite. I can only tell you what I would like to do. I would love to be able to get along with everybody. Right now, the world is a mess. But I think by the time we finish, I think it's going to be a lot better place to live. And I can tell you that, speaking for myself, by the time I'm finished, it's going to be a lot better place to live in, because right now it's nasty.
Trump was asked if Syrians could have launched the chemical attack without the Russians knowing.
I think it's certainly possible. I think it's probably unlikely. And I know they're doing investigations into that right now. I would like to think that they didn't know, but certainly they could have. They were there. So we'll find out. General Mattis is looking into it with the entire Pentagon group that does that kind of work. So, it was very disappointing to see. It's disappointing no matter who does it, but when you get into the gases, especially that form, it's vicious and violent, and everybody in this room saw it all too many times over the last 3 or 4 days. Young children dying, babies dying, fathers holding children in their arms that were dead children. There can't be a worse sight, and it shouldn't be allowed. That's a butcher. So I felt we had to do something about it. I have absolutely no doubt we did the right thing. And it was very, very successfully done, as you well know.
The NATO Secretary General says he looks forward to a more challenging security alliance and more fair burden sharing among the NATO countries. He says what's most important is to stay united.
And be firm and predictable in our approach to Russia. And that means that we have to invest in our collective defense. That's exactly what we are doing. Deploy more troops in the eastern part of the alliance, increase the readiness of our forces, and increase defense spending. And I welcome the very strong message from President Trump on the importance of increased defense spending. We have started to do this, so we are implementing the biggest reinforcement of our collective defense since the end of the Cold War, providing credible deterrence. But at the same time, We have to find ways to engage with Russia, to talk with Russia, because Russia will not go away. Russia will be our biggest neighbor, and we have to find ways to live with them and to try to avoid a new Cold War, a new arms race. And that's exactly why I am very much in favor of what we call the dual-track approach to Russia. And as a former Norwegian politician, I have the experience to work with Russians because Norway is bordering Russia. And Norway was able, even during the Cold War, to develop, I would call it a pragmatic working relationship with Russia, cooperating with them on energy, on border issues, on environment, on fishery, and also in military affairs. And that was not despite our membership in NATO, but it was because of our membership in NATO, because NATO provided the strength, the predictability, the platform for a small country to have a political dialogue with Russia. So I strongly believe that the only way to deter Russia is to be strong, but the only way to avoid a new Cold War, avoid a new arms race, and avoid increasing tensions is to continue to engage Russia in a political dialogue and to make sure that what we do is defensive and proportionate in response to a more assertive Russia.
And this is the news on listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, WBAI in New York at 99.5 FM, streaming at WBAI.org. In local news, Romarley Graham would have been 24 years old today. He probably would have had some sort of celebration had he not been shot dead by the NYPD. Today, his family and several supporting organizations announced the filing of a lawsuit against the NYPD, this for refusing to comply with the state's Freedom of Information law. The party submitted a FOIL request in September 2016, this for records pertaining to the killing of Graham and the related misconduct by multiple officers involved in his killing and its aftermath. Activists say the NYPD has been refusing to comply with the legal request that can provide his family and the public with essential information on Romarley's killing and NYPD misconduct. The move begins another legal battle against the de Blasio administration regarding its compliance with the state's open records law. Constance Malcolm, Romarley Graham's mom, says, "My son should be celebrating his 24th birthday today, but instead my family is being forced to continue fighting for justice because the de Blasio administration has shown no real commitment to justice for him and Black lives." Malcolm and the activists are demanding that the de Blasio administration and the NYPD stop hiding the truth of what happened to Romarley and release the names and files related to the many officers responsible for misconduct. In other local news, environmentalists are praising the New York Department of Environmental Conservation's denial of a water quality permit for construction of the Northern Access Pipeline. It's a 99-mile, 24-inch pipeline proposed to carry natural gas from Pennsylvania to Canada. Andrea Sears reports.
Environmentalists are celebrating Governor Andrew Cuomo's decision to block construction of a 99-mile pipeline through western New York. The 24-inch Northern Access Pipeline would carry natural gas from Pennsylvania to Canada. But late Friday, while all eyes were on the state budget process, the Department of Environmental Conservation quietly denied a critical water quality permit, effectively preventing pipeline construction. According to Alex Beecham with Food and Water Watch, the project would have affected 192 streams and 600 acres of forest and crossed the sole source of drinking water for 20,000 people.
This is a real victory for the grassroots who fought this day in and day out, particularly folks out in western New York who really never let up. And I think without that activism, this victory just doesn't happen.
National Fuel, the company that wants to build the pipeline, says it would create up to 1,200 jobs and provide reliable energy supplies to western New York, the Midwest, and Canada. No word on whether it will appeal the decision or move the pipeline route. But Beecham maintains that building more natural gas infrastructure just deepens reliance on energy sources that harm the environment.
Ultimately, we've got to get off fossil fuels altogether, and this is a huge victory for anybody that wants to transition away from the fossil fuel use that's really locked us into the kind of climate chaos we're living through.
Under the Federal Clean Water Act, states have broad authority to grant or deny permits for pipeline construction. Beecham notes that last year, Cuomo used denial of the same water quality permit to stop construction of the Constitution Pipeline project in eastern New York.
Using this authority twice, I'm hopeful, also sets a precedent for the country. And we really want to see other governors follow suit and stop these pipelines the way that the governor here has, at least in these two instances.
For New York News Connection, I'm Andrea Sears.
Away from Donald Trump's press secretary bungling and other stories being followed by the mainstream press, there's this story out of Port-au-Prince in Haiti by the Associated Press. It tells a story in the ruins of a tropical hideaway. That's where jet setters once sipped rum under the Caribbean sun. Abandoned children tried to make a life for themselves there. They begged and scavenged for food, but they never could scrape together enough to beat back the hunger until the UN peacekeepers moved in a few blocks away. In this explosive report, the Associated Press reports on the abuse of children in Haiti. Here's their story. The men who came from a faraway place and spoke a strange language offered the Haitian children cookies and other snacks. Sometimes they gave them a few dollars, but the price was high. The Sri Lankan peacekeepers wanted sex from girls and boys as young as 12. "I did not even have breasts," said a girl known as VO1. Victim number one. She told UN investigators that over the next 3 years, from ages 12 to 15, she had sex with nearly 50 peacekeepers, including a commandant who gave her 75 cents. Sometimes she slept in UN trucks on the base next to the decaying resort, whose once glamorous buildings were being overtaken by jungle. Justice for victims like VO1 is rare. An Associated Press investigation of UN missions during the past 12 years found nearly 2,000 allegations of sexual abuse and exploitation by peacekeepers and other personnel around the world, signaling the crisis is much larger than previously known. Here in Haiti, at least 134 Sri Lankan peacekeepers exploited 9 children in a sex ring from 2004 to 2007. This, according to an internal UN report obtained by the AP. In the wake of the report, 114 peacekeepers were sent home. None was ever imprisoned. In March, UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres announced new measures to tackle sexual abuse and exploitation by UN peacekeepers and other personnel. "Let us declare in one voice we will not tolerate anyone committing or condoning sexual exploitation and abuse. We will not let anyone cover up these crimes with the UN flag," Guterres said. But the proclamation had a depressingly familiar ring. More than a decade ago, the United Nations commissioned a report that promised to do much the same thing, yet most of the reforms never materialized. For a full 2 years after those promises were made, the children in Haiti were passed around from soldier to soldier. And in the years since, peacekeepers have been accused of sexual abuse the world over. In one particularly grim case in Haiti, a teenage boy said he was gang-raped in 2011 by Uruguayan peacekeepers who filmed the alleged assault on a cell phone. Dozens of Haitian women also say they were raped, and dozens more had what is euphemistically called survival sex in a country where most people live on less than $2.50 a day. That's what the AP found. Haitian lawyer Mario Joseph has been trying to get compensation for victims of a deadly cholera strain linked to Nepalese peacekeepers. It killed an estimated 10,000 people. Now he is also trying to get child support for about a dozen Haitian women left pregnant by peacekeepers. He said, "Imagine if the UN was going to the United States and raping children and bringing cholera. Human rights aren't just for rich white people." U.S. Senator Bob Corker agrees. The Tennessee Republican, who chairs the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, has been calling for reforms in the United Nations. He may well get them under Trump, whose administration has proposed a 31% reduction to the U.S. foreign aid and diplomacy budget. Corker and UN Ambassador Nikki Haley want a review of all missions. Corker recalled his disgust at hearing of the UN sexual abuse cases covered last year in Central African Republic. "If I heard that a UN peacekeeping mission was coming near my home in Chattanooga," he told the AP, "I'd be on the first plane out of here to go back and protect my family." Alleged abusers came from Bangladesh, Brazil, Jordan, Nigeria, Pakistan, Uruguay, and Sri Lanka. This according to UN data and interviews. More countries may have been involved, but the UN only started disclosing alleged perpetrators' nationalities after 2015. Above a rusty bench at an abandoned bus stop in the village of Leogang hangs a sign that reads, "Constructed by the 16th Sri Lanka Peacekeeping Battalion." It's one of the few physical reminders of the battalion's mission, along with children fathered by UN personnel. Marie-Ange Aiti says she met a Sri Lankan commander in December 2006, and he soon began making nighttime visits to her house in Leogang. "By January, we had had sex," she said. "It wasn't rape, but it wasn't exactly consensual either. I felt like I didn't have a choice." She said when she first realized she was pregnant, the Haitian translator assigned to the Sri Lankans told her to have an abortion. Then, she said, UN officials accused her of lying. As she spoke, her daughter, Samantha, sat on her lap wearing an oversized pair of sunglasses with a missing lens. When she was interviewed in August, IET said she had been waiting nearly a decade for the UN to consider her paternity claim to help support her daughter. Finally, early this year, Sri Lankan and UN officials told AP that a one-time payment of $45,243 had been made for Aiti's daughter. The United Nations said Sri Lanka accepted the paternity claim without proof of DNA, and the commander was dismissed from service. But such payments are rare. Some Haitians wonder whether the UN has done more harm than good in a country that has endured tragedy after tragedy since it became the first Black Republic back in 1804. UN personnel say they have contributed to the stability in the Caribbean nation over the years, saved lives during the 2010 earthquake's aftermath, and prevented violence during periods of unrest. The mission, which currently has nearly 5,000 personnel and is expected to scale down by October, has also been credited with training police, providing security during elections, and support to the judiciary. Many are not convinced, though. "I'd like to see my attacker face to face and tell him how he has destroyed my life," said 21-year-old Melita Joseph, who said she was raped by one peacekeeper and narrowly escaped being gang raped in Cite Soleil, a seaside slum. Like others, she never reported the crime. "They'll look at this as one big joke," she said. "As far as the UN goes, they came here to protect us, but all they brought is destruction." And that from an investigation by the Associated Press on UN peacekeepers and the child sex ring. And that's the WBAI Evening News for Wednesday, April 12, 2017. Linda Perry, WBAI News, New York.